My name's Bridget. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is December 27th of 1991, and I have a sponsor and a home group, and I want to thank Billy for asking me to come out here again. He figured out, I feel like the last time I was here is about 8 years ago, so I remember the room in the high school, and it's really good to be back. And I want to thank my friends for coming with me on the road trip down here. And I loved what Matt just read. I've never heard that as a way to open a meeting, but it really does. It's so true. And that's what we do. So I'm going to tell you, just like he said, in a general way, what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And just, up front, I got sober when I was 21. I had drank for 8.5 years. And so I've been sober. I celebrated 23 years this past December, which was not my plan at all. But I did I did really identify with what he just read of when I did come to my first meeting where I was actually listening and not court ordered or, and from my DUIs, but my first meeting that I came to, the first meeting of my home group, I remember exactly that happening to me. I came into the meeting and I identified immediately. I don't remember what it was like. It's a speaker's meeting. I don't remember what the girl said. It was like a girl and a guy who spoke. And I remember having that identification immediately. And I had that thing of like, okay, I am really an alcoholic and I really fit here. I really belong here. And I left my first meeting that I was going to because I wanted to go with something that I hadn't had in a really long time. And it was that gift of a little bit of hope that maybe, just maybe, I'd be able to not drink, because I believed that you guys didn't drink. And I still remember that leaving my home group for the first time when, you pick up a one-day chip and the girls kind of like getting me in the bathroom, coming and giving your phone number. I didn't have a cell phone. I was like, tell my kids, I didn't have a cell phone until I was 28. So that's when they can have a cell phone. But I do remember the girls coming and giving me their number. And I remember my dad's an alcoholic and he's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He celebrates 33 years in August. But I remember my dad, I met with my mom and dad and I met my ADS counselor. I had a couple of DUIs, and that hope that you guys have given me, that's made all the difference. I felt it when I had that identification, and that has been and continues to be one of the most important things to me, is to that sense of identification. As I've heard that one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to reduce those feelings of difference, just like it said, saying I've got this and I'm going to do what I'm willing to do what you say. But that's just what I was thinking at the reading. But I did drink for 8.5 years. Started drinking, 13, the summer before eighth grade, I think it was. And I, looking back, it's easy for me to say, from a way 2020 hindsight perspective, is that I felt uncomfortable as a kid. I am someone who felt uncomfortable. I had a great deal of fear. I felt, I just didn't feel comfortable. I felt afraid of you. I felt like you didn't like me. I just lived with a sense of discomfort. And I don't think that makes me an alcoholic, but what alcohol did for that, was a priceless thing, as you know. But when I started drinking, I did not become a daily drinker. I drank on the weekends. I liked drinking, and I was just at a meeting. I feel like it was maybe my home group last week. I can't remember exactly where the woman speaking talked about crossing the line, and I've heard many people share their experience of, there's a time in which you cross a line from social to alcoholic drinking. And I think I took a drink and crossed that line. And that's just my experience. I took a drink, and my parents got separated because my dad's drinking. He went into detox, and he left me with like a seasoned alcoholic's liquor cabinet. You know, he moved out. I had his alcohol, and I was glad he was gone because I was like, you know, you weren't there for me as a kid. I don't need you now. You know, unless it's Christmas or my birthday and you want to give me something, I really don't want anything to do with you, but I will take your alcohol and your money. And I would say that. And so anyways, I, you know, lined up the drinks. I, you know, took shots of various things, of no idea, laid out newspapers. I knew I'd have some kind of reaction. And I, you know, I loved it. I didn't like feel like it went from black and white to color necessarily, but I felt like I liked it. I wanted to do it. I wanted to drink. And, you know, I acted, I think, like I had more fun than I did. But I loved the way alcohol made me feel. And, you know, I drank on the weekends. I drank, you know, with friends. I had been like straight A's, whatever. School was important. I was very close to my mom and my sister. They were important, and very quickly that was to disappear. And I got into, you know, I finally felt like I found like that belonging with a group of people. My high school went from 7th grade to 12th grade and felt like it was never going to end, and so long. But I finally found my group of people, they were like the freaks. Like, we would, you know, skip school and smoke and drink, go to Grateful Dead shows, and I was like, you know, I so desperately wanted to fit in there. I still remember, like, I would read album covers and try to memorize the words to these songs, and I really desperately wanted that to belong somewhere, and I did. I got into there, but my consequences for drinking were almost immediate. They were a small price to pay for what alcohol did for me, but I was a pass-out drinker. I was immediately a blackout drinker. You know, sometimes I would drink and I'd throw up, and then I realized that if you throw up, then you can drink more, so that was good, actually. But the blackouts were almost instant. And you know, I had that phenomenon of craving from the beginning, where I took a drink, and I didn't, you know, and obviously I didn't have those words to say it's a phenomenon of craving, but that is what happened. I took a drink, and I took a drink, and I took a drink, until I blacked out, I passed out, ran into a tree, you know, whatever happened. And by the time I was in 10th grade, I had, you know, done this work program at school where you could go from like 8 to noon and then you could go to work and it would count for school credits. And I was like, so I did that. I'd get out of school at like noon and go to work. And I had met a guy who was older and could buy alcohol, and my drinking really started to become much more frequent, and I also got a job that I would steal from, and they didn't have computers, so you could just take the money and put it in your shoe or whatever, and about this time of my drinking, around 10th, 11th grade, I started doing, you know, I had those consequences of drinking, yet I still loved it. I loved it, absolutely loved how it made me feel. I could pass out at a Grateful Dead show. I could pass out at an Eric Clapton concert. I could be I had to be babysat. So I started stealing money and I started buying cocaine so I could control my drinking. And so when I could do like lines of cocaine, then I could drink more. And which is what I wanted to do. I wanted to not control my drink. I wanted to be able to drink as much as I could, as often as I could, without as high of consequences. By the time I graduated from high school, you know, I had no real friends. I had this guy that I was dating who, you know, once I took a drink, I mean, it was just like drink. I was in a violent relationship. We were in a violent relationship, and that was both ways. Like, I would drink, I would have black eyes, I would have, you know, I would be like, I'd get drunk and be like, take me home, and he'd be like, fine, I'm gonna take you home, and then I'd be like, no, I don't want you to take me home, and I'd like break his gear shift, which I did a couple times, so then we couldn't go anywhere. And so it was a very violent, a very violent relationship. My, you know, my mom was like, you can never see this person and whatnot. But of course I did. And by the time I graduated from high school, you know, I had this idea. I'd been at this school from 7th to 12th grade, and I had this idea, like, when you graduate, you should feel a certain way. Like, I don't know, you've accomplished something. Like, it's a good thing. And I felt like that's the first time I remember feeling like I had the consciousness that thought that I had to take a drink. Like, I knew I felt like I hated myself so much. I had all the friends I had made in high school and stuff, nobody wanted to be around me anymore because the only thing I wanted to do was drink. And so I was just with this guy, no invites to any graduation parties or anything like that, like totally isolated, except with this guy who I remember, like, going after graduation over to his house and lived in his parents' basement and just seeing a glimpse of myself in the mirror and knowing, like, I have to take a drink, and a drink made me feel better, and despite the consequences. And about a week after I graduated from high school was when I began to hit my bottom. And I graduated in 88, in June of 88, and I got sober in December of 91. So from June of 88 to 91, I kind of went down in my story to what I hope really is my bottom. And I had gotten a job at a Midas muffler shop by the place I worked as, like, a counter person, and I was supposed to start. And I had, you know, one of those days where I went to, like, Wilmer's Park, and it was, like, bands playing all day, and I blacked out, passed out. You know, it was like an all-day drinking thing. And by whatever time in the morning it was, I was going to drive home, and I got my... And I've heard a speaker say this, like, that seconds and inches, like, seconds and inches, and I wouldn't be here, or you'd have another speaker, or whatever. And that's, like, one of my first things. Like, I hit a woman head-on on my way home, like, in a blackout, but kind of coming out of blackout, and I kind of clipped her, you know, my front left with her front left. So, luckily, I didn't. She was not hurt at all, and I just, I totaled my car into a tree, and I was like, came to with the ambulance and stuff, and I was like, I wasn't driving that car, you know, that was somebody else, and like a crazy person, like, whose head is busted and bleeding anyway. So they took me to the hospital, and I remember being handcuffed to the bed, and this one guy was there with this kid saying I was belligerent, and I was like, this is not the picture of myself that I have in my mind, but this is the reality. I'm like a belligerent drunk, you know, scaring a little kid, refusing a breathalyzer test because my friends had said, if you ever get pulled over for DUI, refuse a breathalyzer. And so eventually I, you know, wait, go to the jail for the night. You could smoke there then. I was like, this is cool. I knew the magistrate. He gave me cigarettes. And it's like, not a big deal. And I woke up, you know, came to whatever in the morning. I remember my parents came and picked me up, and I felt bad. I had that feeling of, like, this isn't how it's supposed to be. That's not what my life's supposed to look like or whatever. But I was drinking either that night or the next night. It didn't matter. But I did have that feeling of, like, some kind of conscience still alive, like, which was soon to be gone. And then I started working at this muffler shop. I was, like, totally messed up physically. So I started a couple days later. But that's really where I hit my bottom. I became a daily drinker. I was in this violent relationship. I would drink pretty much every day. I'm like, I would never take my car to a place like this because we all drank. And everybody working on the cars, the manager, I mean, we drank. We had cocaine under the couch upstairs, a little loft with the TV, could watch football games, and cocaine lines under the thing, and vodka in the lockers, and beer full of a fridge full of beer. And it was like heaven. I absolutely loved it. And I loved the people I was with. I was starting school in the fall. And I went to a couple semesters of college before I, like, signed up and couldn't go anymore. But this was really was to become my life. And that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, I drove drunk almost every night. Every day I was drinking. I was driving until I got my second DUI and sold my car because I couldn't stop. I knew there was no way I could stop drinking, so I had to sell my car because I didn't want to be a three-time offender in Virginia at that time. And but over that year, I was drinking pretty much every day and had to. And I took a drink, and it was, like, off. And I was, like, you know, I had gotten in it with this guy. You know, we were off again, and I was in an on-again episode with him. You know, by this time, nobody at my work would let me see him. My mom wouldn't let me see him. And so we'd sneak around and see him. And I would go to, like, this bar with the people from work after work, and he came and picked me up. And there was that one time where we were driving, and he pushed me out of the truck and ran over me forwards, like my feet. And then he was, like, putting it in reverse to come back, and some guys hopped out. And I was, like, I remember the police coming. I remember this one of those other times I'm stealing, like, the peace of mind of my mom, who's now sleeping with the windows open, her purse in her room. You know, and I'm coming home with the police again, and they're, like, carrying me, you know, and they're, like, you're going to press malicious. You know, it was just insane. So then I met a guy in a blackout that I ended up moving in with, and who was, like, a bass player in a band. And I was literally, I felt so disgusted by myself. Like, I was sleeping with the people at work. I was living with this guy that I hated, but really I hated myself. I would sleep in, like, another room. I just felt disgusting, and I felt like I had to drink. And by the end, I moved out of there. I got my second DUI before I moved in with the guy. I went to visit him, and I got my second DUI. And I remember feeling like when I got my first one, I eventually did a breathalyzer. I was like a 0.23, like, hours later. I was really drunk. This time I was like, you know, I did not feel drunk, but legally I was drunk. And I remember that feeling of, like, you know what, it's a small price to pay. And I, like, it's not a big deal, you know, and they sentenced me to, like, weekends in jail. And I remember calling my mom collect before they would say, you know, now they say you're getting a collect call from such and such jail. Before it would just be like collect call. So I call my mom. I'm like, yeah, I'm on my way down to the beach. You know, and meanwhile, I'm, like, in jail, like, watching TV with the people who aren't getting out. And they're like, have a hamburger for me when you get out and watch the game. And I'm like, oh, my God. And but it was, you know, the consequences were getting greater. And my ability to deal with I'm lowering, you know, it's like, so still, the consequences are getting greater. And I absolutely had to drink. I could not imagine at this point not drinking. It wasn't possible. And so I got that DUI. I did that. My boyfriend picked me up at, like, you know, 7 o'clock on a Sunday, and I had drinking a 12 pack by the time we got back to his house. And that was how eventually I did what our book talks about, you know, try to control my drinking. And I was going to go back to school, and this time I was going to live on campus. It's going to be different. It's going to go away from the guys from work that were, like, the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization things. As you know, I would sit up in the loft at the muffler shop over the weekend and literally drink myself in and out of consciousness and do some cocaine. I'd wake up, I'd act like I had friends, but really I was, like, living up in that loft, and then I would go home, and it was miserable. And so I was going to go back to school, I was going to live there, and so this was, like, in the fall of 91. And, of course, you know, my dad has had a couple talks with me, very few. Like, if you just want to stop drinking, you know, just don't drink today. And I was like, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard, you know. I'm like, why would I not drink today if I know I'm going to drink tomorrow? It just didn't make any sense. I was like, no way. And so, and like I said, I had very little to do with him, very little. But every now and then, you know, but he did what I hope I can do, you know, for somebody who might be watching, is he, that you don't know who's watching, you know, and he, you know, he didn't have to say a lot, but he lived his life in such a way as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that I knew something was different. And, but he never pushed AA on me. He never, you know, was like, you know, sometimes I'm like, God, I have two kids now, and if my kids were doing what I was doing, they'd be in, like, my own jail. I would make a jail and put them in there or something. Like, and not a chance that they're going to do it. But anyway, that would, you know, I am, you know, we were kind of talking before the meeting, I am grateful for everything that has happened in my, you know, to get me to my bottom, because there's never been a doubt inside me of what's wrong with me once I got here. Like, I'm 100% alcoholic. And so anyways, Billy warned me the time is going to fly by. So it is. And I was like, so I'm going to go back to school. I'm away from both guys. I told, you know, I sold my car because I couldn't stop drinking and driving, and I was scared to go to jail for a long time. Weekend was more than enough. And so I was living up at Mason, and I had a roommate and who left very quickly. You know, she was not into my drinking. And so I had my own room at school, and my life had become, I would wake up in the morning, I had that, my kids the other day were also talking about they wanted a mini fridge, and I was like, I've had a mini fridge, you know. And I had a mini fridge by my bed full of beer. I'd wake up in the morning, I'd drink a couple of beers, I'd brush my teeth with my finger, use the trash can as a toilet where I would, like, spit my, you know, toothpaste or whatever if I did it. And I had a bike, because I didn't have a car, and that's how I would get going. I remember that last time I went to class once, and I, like, sat away from the door, and I felt like I was going to fall apart in a million pieces. There was not a chance I could sit through classes, you know. I only needed to drink. And so that's what I did. I quit my job. I was like, and there's three people who were really instrumental in the what happened part of my story. Like, that, this is what it used to be like. The first person was my dad. The second person was this guy, Carrie, the one sober guy that worked at the smuggler shop. At one point had me come to his one-year anniversary. You know, he's like, please, just come. You can drink after, whatever. And so I went. And he was always there, like, if you ever need help, I'm here, you know. And then from my DUIs, I had gotten this counselor named Billy, who literally saved my life. Mm-hmm. And he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was he worked for, you know, ADS, Alcohol and Drug Treatment Center. And so Carrie, at this time, I was like, and Billy also did what my dad did, and so did Carrie. He lived his life, and when I would go periodically, I would show up for my court-ordered, you know, classes or whatever. And he was the happiest person I encountered in my life, period, without exception, this guy Billy. And I knew I identified with him too, you know, from the very little bit that he shared, you know. And I was like, he was the happiest person that I was encountering by far. But this guy, Karras, like, went to work one morning, biked to work, drank a fifth of vodka. It was like 10:30 in the morning. And I was like, I got to go home. Like, somebody's got to take me home. Can somebody finish working for me? And he was like, I was like, I think I need to go to rehab. And he was like, oh, my God, yeah, we can go and we can get you into whatever. And I was like, whoa, 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 not that fast, you know. But he took me home. And so he was there. He was, like, at New Beginnings. And anyways, so the last couple, whatever, month or it's like school starts in August. I got sober in December. I went into rehab I went into detox in October. So from August to October, I did that routine of waking up and drinking every morning. I remember I was starting flipping my mattresses. I had no control over my bladder. I would just always wet the bed. And when my roommate moved out, I was like, cool, because I could use her mattress. And it would be like, you know, the double flipping. And when I remember showering once. And I remember having that, like, you know, bringing your little bag and having beer in my bag to bring into the shower. And I'm like, even somebody as insane as I am has to think that that's crazy. I couldn't take a shower without drinking beer. And I was like, I had no idea what to do. And that's when I called my dad. And I think about this part, and anytime I hear somebody, you know, share their experience, just like the stories in the book, like Matt read, you know, and they talk about this is what it used to be like, right? I could not stop drinking. Drinking was my only answer to anything in life. Anybody to tell me not to drink was an idiot. You know, like, of course I'm going to drink. It is, although I didn't have the vocabulary, it's the only thing I had to deal with life on life's terms was take a drink. Whether that was positive or negative perceived circumstances in my life, my answer to that is to take a drink. And at this point where people say the what happened, for me to this day is where I feel that connection with a higher power, because I can't keep myself from taking a drink for a day, or let alone not think about it, you know. And so I called my dad, and he came and picked me up in that, you know, 0.13, talking just like I am now, kind of maintenance, wake up, drink a couple beers, do the toothbrush thing, and my dad came to my dorm room and picked me up to take me to detox. I called him. He came and picked me up. We went, it was like on a Friday, we went in, and I was, like, drunk, you know, legally, but not for me. And they were like, okay, there's not a bed, but if you come back on Monday, you know, we will get you somewhere. And I was like, I don't think you understand. If you let me leave here, I'm going to 7-Eleven, and I'm going to buy that beer, and I'm going to drink it. I can't stop, which was not my plan to say. It's the first, like, in my own story, the, you know, the circumstance, or for me, the evidence of higher power working in my life. I hear it in everybody's story when I'm listening. Which isn't always, but when I am, I hear it. And so they got me in, obviously, which is like, thank God. And, you know, and they gave me Xanax to detox, which was awesome. And I was like, this is cool. But I met a guy in detox, because what do you do in detox? You meet a guy, right? And so we're going to go out, we're going to stay sober together. And it was a disaster. And, you know, so I got out of detox, and then I'm back living at my mom's, and everyone's watching me now, you know. And I'm like, and I called this guy, Billy, from the hospital. I was like, can you please help me? And he was like, come to Sunday night, meet me at the meeting. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm locking that in my mind. But meanwhile, I meet the guy. We're going to stay sober together. We're going to go to AA, get out of detox. My dad's like, you do not need to go to long-term rehab. You need to go to AA. Went to a couple of meetings. I went to a meeting with this guy. We walked, like, in the door and out the door. And I was like, AA is not for me. You know, like, whatever. Like, and so I continued to drink and, you know, had another incident with the guy, the violent one. And I just remembered that. That total hopelessness. And then I met Billy at Midtown, met this counselor. And I lied about my sobriety date for the first 18 months I was sober. And I said my sobriety date was December 15th, but really it was the 27th. And so I met Billy. He introduced me. I went to Midtown, all the girls, whatnot. And I met my first sponsor, who came. You know, I was in ADS 3 nights a week in Burke, and she lived in Lake Crystal City, and they would come and get me and take me to meetings. I'd lost my, as a result of my second DUI, I'd lost my license for 3 years, so I had no car, no license, and people came and got me. But I did drink. My last drink was December 26th. You know, I went out of town with family and could not handle being sober, and so I took some NyQuil and some warm beer when I got back, and I had that, like, I can't stop. And then my sobriety date's December 27th, and I started going to meetings. People picked me up. It's like, you don't know what happens. So, like, why am I going to get in the car with people I don't know and do everything that they're doing and be, and it's crazy when I think about it looking back. I would have done anything that anybody asked me to do. Without even thinking about it, that gift of desperation of being, like, beaten down by alcohol. I was like, it just felt, and I felt that identification. I felt like you guys knew what was wrong with me. You knew it, and you were sober, and you were happy. And so anyways, I started going to meetings. I had the obsession to drink every day. I would wake up, and I would still think about it. And I was thinking about this a lot recently, a lot. And I feel like at that time, it was like, 51% of me wanted to stay sober, and 49% of me really wanted to take a drink. And it was just that. And thank God for the people in AA that made me, like my, that guy Billy introduced me to my first sponsor, who introduced me, he introduced me to my home group, which is still my home group. My sponsor is not my sponsor anymore. She drank after a little bit. I got another sponsor, but every day I would go to a noon meeting. Needless to say, I failed out of school. They asked me to leave for a little while. They don't like it if you don't go to class and don't withdraw, which is what I did. And got like Fs, like two semesters of Fs. So a couple months, and I was unemployable, didn't have a job. And for some reason, I also had that, you know, where I got sober, there's a lot of people who get sober young. You know, I was 21. And, you know, I had the gift of not having anybody who wanted to hang out with me. You know, I didn't have any old friends call. I had the one guy that we were in a relationship for off and on for 5 years called once. And I was like, I'm sober. I don't ever want to talk to you again. That is the last that I've heard in 23 years from people that I drank with. And which really was a gift because I didn't have that pull to, like, hang out with old friends. I didn't have any old friends left. And I just had you guys. And so I, you know, I got a sponsor. I started going to meetings. And like a couple months into my sobriety, this is my sobriety date, you know, I went to a noon meeting and I was on my way home and it hit me. Like, I had not thought about taking a drink from the time I got up till leaving the noon meeting. And I feel like that was my first experience with the first and second step. Like, you know, at least conscious. Like, I knew that there was no way I could keep from taking a drink, and I hadn't even thought about it. And I was like, I knew it was because I was with you. I had come to believe in AA, and I knew I was alcoholic. I knew by myself that my best is drinking myself in and out of consciousness, wetting the bed, showering with beer. That's the best I can get me. And I didn't think about taking a drink, and that obsession left. And I haven't had that obsession to drink. It's probably been just about 23 years. I haven't had the obsession to drink, which I believe is another gift, you know. And all those circumstances that happened that allowed me to get that little bit of time to get to that place. To me, whenever I hear somebody talk about their life going in this way, something happens. They're going in another different direction. It is like, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, because there is no question. Normally I would say this in the beginning, but that reading really like threw me off, but in a good way. But it's like every single thing in my life is, whether you want to call it good, bad, whatever, everything in my life is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Without AA, I have absolutely nothing in my life, because that's how I got here. So I had that experience of like, wow, it felt like a freedom. I don't have that obsession to drink on me every day. And that really was my last kind of dabbling in the steps that I was to do for a little while. You know, I got sober. I got, you know, involved in a group. I got friends and running buddies. I got a boyfriend, you know, and then I was coming up on a year sober, and I felt so crazy that I felt like I started to go get some brain scans, you know, secretly without telling anybody to figure out what is wrong with me. Because I'm starting to have panic attacks. I'm starting to have to pull over on the side of the road and keep brown paper bags, stone cold sober. Panic attack, breathing on the side of 495 or 66 or wherever I was. I started to feel like I was, one of my friends in my home group would talk about the brain and there being this membrane. And you exist up here, but some people cross down and they get trapped in the bottom part of their brain and they can't get back up. And I was like, oh my God, I'm that person. Like, I am crazy. And I was like, didn't want to go outside because the sun hurt my eyes. I'm like, I have blue eyes. Maybe it's because I have blue eyes, lighter eyes, the more sensitive your eyes are. Maybe I need vitamins. like a crazy person from 1 year to 3 years sober, you know, and hit that. And that is, like, when I first got sober, I heard Clancy talk about an alcohol problem and alcoholism. And he would say, I don't have a drinking problem. I have a living problem. I have alcoholism. And I was like, okay, I cannot wrap my mind around this. Like, and he would say, stopping drinking has no effect on me whatsoever except to gradually make life so unbearable that I'm either going to drink again or I'm going to change. And I, at 18 months sober, I was like, I've got that now. Thank you. Like, I felt like so crazy. I was sleeping with a number of times. I obviously had broken up with a boyfriend and moved back home, whatever. But I was sleeping with a number of a mental institution by my bed, and I would, like, wake up in a panic and just, like, look at the number and think, if it gets that bad, I can go to this mental hospital. They will take care of me. I won't have to worry about doing anything. And that would give me the sense of comfort. And that is what got me into the steps of AA, is that place of, like, I'm stone cold sober. And if I don't have a drink, I have got to have a sufficient substitute. And just going to meetings and having some friends and doing that was no longer a sufficient substitute. It was for a little while. It got me the obsession to drink. And it, you know, I'm so grateful for the group that I did fall into, because I, you know, I was 21 and I was like, what was I going to do? You know, I was so glad to fall into a group where I still am sober with people that I got sober with. Not a lot, but I'm still sober with a number of people that I got sober right around the same time. And so it was an active group, and it gave me something to do. But my own alcoholism, when I got that, you know, from 18 months to 3 years period of my sobriety, that is... You know, I think about it and I'm like terrified. I would not want to go through that experience again. However, it gave me conviction in who and what I am, that I really am powerless over alcohol, that my life, I fully conceded to my innermost self in that madness that I'm an alcoholic. And I was like reading We Agnostics and so relating to the bedevilments, where it talks about we're a prey to misery and depression. We can't seem to be of real use to anybody. We're unhappy. We're useless. And I was like, oh, my God, yes, that is how I felt sober. And then I was, like, reading The Promises, and I was like, we're going to know new freedom and new happiness. We're not going to regret the past. And I was like, more than anything, I wanted to get from where I was to what The Promises said. I wanted to get there, and I believe that if I took the actions that were written in between those parts of the book, that could happen for me. And I came to believe that if I do what this says, I came to believe that this power greater than myself that I connect to in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, because my faith in a higher power is so riddled with doubt that pushes me forward, that I you know, for a while I'd be like, I don't know. I have so much doubt. But I don't think it's such a bad thing. It's my truth, and it pushes me to keep looking. But and so I came to believe that if I do this, and I was like, I will turn my will and my life over to anybody who will freaking take it, because I can't stand living in my skin. And it was like that third step, and I was that crazy brain scan getting person, and again I was in a meeting at Ocean City, where I would go to a beach house, and I met this woman who talked about being right where I was in sobriety, and how she would, like, before she gets up out of bed, she gets on her knees and prays a third step prayer. And I was like, okay, I'll do that, you know, because I'm going to blow my brains out if something doesn't give. And so I started doing that. I started to do prayer. I had written a fourth step when I was like 10, 11 months sober, but I really felt like I wasn't resentful. I was just, my friend helped me write it. Like, yes, you should be mad at this. And I was like, no connection to it. And so I did write a fourth step. And still, even when I did do my fourth step, and I still felt kind of like I was writing about a fictional character, and like not a whole lot of connection to it. Although I did do it, I did do a fifth step, I did keep moving forward, but I felt like the fears part, that part I really got. My part column was a little foggy, but I did it, and I started, then I wrote my eighth step list, and pain is the book says it's like a touchstone of spiritual growth, and that really has been my experience. Everything's fine, whatever, I'm going to do this. But when I wrote my eighth step, and only, like it says, I wrote the people and what I had done. And something happened when I read that to my sponsor that I was like, for the first time, literally, I was like, wow, my life is my fault. Like, I don't have very many, like, pinpointable experiences. Like, oh, yeah, my perspective changed. But that one really was a big one for me, to be able to see my part. And of course, you know, my dad was a bummer. You know, the people who loved and trusted me, the people closest to me, it's not a ton of people, but the closer you are to me, the more I have hurt you. You know what I mean? It's just my family members, employers, you know, a couple friends. But my dad was high on that list. You know, my mom was high on that list. My sister was high on that list. And they're the top three. And so I started making amends. I made amends with my dad. My dad and I, to this day, we give each other our chips, you know, and we have, there's nothing between us anymore. And that's the person I hated the most. If you had a dad like I did, I'm hiding in the closet, he's coming home drunk, I'm scared, you would drink too, which doesn't make any sense. But I blamed him, and there's nothing there. And with my mom, you know, that's been a harder relationship. I sometimes am like, not everything is perfectly how I would, you know. I mean, I wish it could be different than how it is, you know, but everything's not like a storybook happy ending. You know, not that I didn't talk to my mom for like 45 minutes today, but there's still, I feel like it's going to be a lifetime of repair. And it's been 23 years. It's been a long time, and it's been a lot of years of, you know, even when I had my daughter, she's 10 and a half, and when I had my first kid, I felt like I saw a lot more harms, you know, than I could have before that time. Because I think about how much, you know, I love my daughter. And then I think about the harm that I've caused my mom and how I would feel in that situation. And I was like, oh, my God. It's a lot. And she was the person who slept with the windows open, listening for ambulance sounds, like thinking that was going to be me and that level of peace of mind. But still, you know, it's not like 100% perfect. And the same with my sister. And I've learned, you know, I've made amends. And then as I've gone through sobriety, I've caused more harm and I've made amends. And I've gone through, you know, thinking about that stuff. And when I was probably 8 years sober, I went through another, like, terrible breakup, whatever. I have very high reactions, high emotional reactions to normal life circumstances, which pushed me into the steps, you know what I mean, which really is, like, kind of how it is. But I remember my sponsor saying, you know, I'd sponsored a couple people, you know, I'd gotten really into, I wrote 10-step inventories, like this size, small writing, every day, same thing, over and over and over again, which I don't think is what the 10-step really is, but I was like, you know, that was part of my process. I was like, I'm doing the same thing every day, you know, what is wrong with me that this is not, I'm not learning from this, I'm not, whatever, but eventually I did, and I started, you know, I have no religious upbringing. I learned the Lord's Prayer when I got sober by holding hands with people. But I started to, you know, I remember a woman who also, again, made an impression on me, the 11th step. She's a PhD in religion, sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, amazing woman. And she was like, traveled, whatever, did all this stuff. And she's like, we're so fortunate because everything I've learned in getting my PhD for religion is, like, condensed in the 11th step and the 12 and 12. Like, we're so lucky that we're given that. And it's like, you know, and so I started, you know, AA started to become more and more and more and more of my life, you know. And I'm very grateful that I've never felt so amazing that I've gotten far away from AA. You know what I mean? Like, I've always been, you know, had just enough going on to know that I'm not better. You know, I'm not better. I'm still alcoholic. I still have, you know, when people would say, you know, alcohol stopped working for me, I don't relate to that. You know, my consequences got higher, but I know what works for me. Like, deep down inside me, and I hear speakers talk about that too, like, if it gets too much and I'm that afraid or that upset or something, I know what alcohol will do for me. And that is my alcoholism inside of me. And that if I don't have that sufficient substitute, I'm either going to be drinking or I'm going to have a spiritual substitute in AA, because I can't live without one of the two. So if I'm not doing this, I will be drinking. You know, it's just like the way it is. And but at that, like, 8-9 year mark, my sponsor's like, you better get busy helping other people get what they need. And I was like, I hate you. You know, I'm in pain. Don't you see? You know, whatever. And but honestly, it did that, trying to help other people. And somebody said, if you're looking at a pie chart, you should be giving 90% and receiving 10%. And if that's how you want to look at your day or whatever you're doing and who you're helping and how you're getting help, that's what it should look like. You should be giving 90%. And I was like, that is ridiculous. You know, obviously I'm not going to say that. But that is how I felt. And but it has made all, having people has made all the difference in my life. Because I was like, I really relate to the, you know, that terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair that the book talks about. That is what I, you know, how I came here. You know, I've really quickly wanted to touch on the last thing that's been going on. You know, I got married, had a couple kids. Luckily, you know, I was so afraid that I was going to have kids and get away from AA, or get married and get away from AA. And that has not been my experience. I've been able to do whatever it has been and stay very close to AA, because, you know, I believe I'm just as powerless today as I was 23 and some odd months ago. But recently, over the past couple of years, my husband got sober when he was really young. And he, over the past, it's probably been 2.5 years, has come to that conclusion that he is not an alcoholic. And I was his number one supporter through that process of him kind of looking at you know, his own story. He's always stretched to identify, which is not my experience at all. You know, I don't have any problem identifying, but he did. And you know, I'm, you know, as a number one supporter of that. And now that he probably, it's probably about 6 months ago that that's gone by, and he has recently went on a business or on a golfing trip and had a couple drinks, and my reaction to that, you know, it has been so strong that it was like, and it made me think of that, and I was at a meeting, you know, I was like, I'm upping my meetings, I'm talking to my sponsor, you know, because I've got to do what I've got to do, and it's not like he's ever going to, you know, it's not... not like he would ever do anything that would threaten my sobriety. I think he has a great respect for me and for my sobriety. And but knowing that that element, you know, it has made me know more than ever that inside of me there is that still that alcoholism. There's the alcoholism and the sober person. And I was at a meeting, you know, on Wednesday, where they're talking about, you know, some Native Indian, you know, folk tale that there's like a white dog and a black dog inside of you, and it's which one are you going to feed? Are you going to feed? And this guy was talking about a sober dog or a drunk dog. Like, I've got them both. It's which one am I going to feed? And that experience has made me ever more aware of, you know, I have a daily reprieve contingent on my maintenance and my spiritual condition. I have a fatal illness. It will kill me if I don't treat it. It doesn't matter what anybody else does. And I don't say that to, like, talk poorly about my husband or anything, because I support him 100%. I think he's one of the most amazing people that I've ever met. And that's the same. But it has made me very aware of my own alcoholism, which has been... You know, I feel like it's another one of those things that keeps me really close. And I hope that I never get too well to not know that I desperately need you guys to stay sober. So with that, thanks for having me out here. Thanks for letting me talk.